Okay, everyone, Joseph's done thank yous, but I'd also like to say thank you to Barbara as well, and thank you to Stephen for travelling so far and coming here and speaking today. It's really fantastic. It's been a long day, but I hope it's been insightful, invigorating, and stimulating. I mean, I've had a really good time with all the sessions. So I'm going to hand over to Stephen. He's probably had the hardest job of the day. He's had to go around every single one of the sessions and kind of get a kind of idea of what's been going on during the day, and hopefully, Tip, are you going to sum up what's been going on?
I don't know what I'm going to do.
Well, just to give you a bit of introduction, I'll give you your formal title. You're a Senior Research Officer at National Research Council in Canada, and I'm thinking this up as well, I think, an acknowledged history and leading voice in emerging technologies. But I think most of you know that Stephen's written quite extensively on social software, web to e-learning, from both kind of technological standpoints and from philosophical standpoints as well. So, over to you, Stephen.
Well, thanks everyone, and I want to say, first of all, what a pleasure it is to be here in London, despite the fact that it's way too humid for me here. But at least you brought on the nice weather, I really appreciate that. Although not quite Toronto nice weather. Toronto nice weather was 30 degrees and this much humidity, and it was a walking sponge. I'm glad you're giving me a lot of leeway. I had the task of summarizing, but not really summarizing, because of course you guys did summaries, and the people who were at all of the sessions for the entire length of the session had a better idea of what went on in them than I did. I had the task of sort of floating between sessions and trying to get a sense of what happened here, and I don't know if I have a sense of what happened here, but this is what you're going to get. And so you run the risk when you ask for a talk like this, it might be okay, it might be really bad, or anywhere in between. So here's, and this is what I ended up with. I came here, I listened to the talks, I listened to Barbara's talk, and all the different sessions and that, and then I went upstairs, and what entered my mind and came out the other end as a PowerPoint presentation. How I became blog literate and what blog literacy meant to me. Always when I think about learning, I always think about my own education, because my own education was a very educational experience for me. And, I compare in my mind always, and I think we all do this, what we're doing now as educators and what's happening in classrooms now with what happened in our own lives. Well, my life began, not the day I was born, in a biological sense, sure, but my life began in a grade 10 classroom. Oh, sure, I did stuff before that. I built tree houses and raced my bicycle in tree houses, which was not recommended. But in grade 10, I had an English teacher. He was a young, dynamic English teacher, fresh out of graduate school, and he came out to our small rural school in Metcalfe, Ontario. And when the newfangled idea was everyone would write journals. And the elders in the school sort of scratched their head and didn't really know what to make of it, but it wasn't harming anyone. Well, I took off on this. And other people wrote their journals, and that was fine. And me, I wrote about that much stuff over the course of the year. And because I thought I was writing for somebody, as it turned out, he didn't really read it, so. But, what do you do? I did, and he gave me, all of us, complete freedom. He said, I don't care if you write. You do anything. So I made some crossword puzzles. I drew some pictures. I copied some stuff. I wrote an entire series of short stories, and it shows my English background and heritage. Hemlock Holmes, consulting detective, and his loyal assistant, Henry Higgins. And I wrote the complete novels of Hemlock Holmes. And that carried with me, that stayed with me. I still have most of that journal, parts of it I deleted. And when I went to university, I found a similar sort of freedom when I worked for the student newspaper. Now, there's a certain person, I believe, still in this audience who believes that you cannot listen to somebody and take notes at the same time. I won't mention any names. I learned how to do that in university, working for the student newspaper, where the deadlines were ridiculous, and if you didn't write the story while you were conducting the interview, it wasn't going to get printed. So it can be done. I am a walking instance of a person who can listen and write at the same time. And many other people are. Ewan McIntosh has already proved that today with his blogging in the sessions earlier. And I imagine there's some blogging going on now, maybe. The group upstairs, I was with one of the groups upstairs and made the comment, because I was asked, and you know, I was supposed to be lurking, but I was asked anyway, to talk about literacies and transliteracies, and I made the comment that how I became literate was indeed accidental. And of course, this isn't strictly true. You know, people did teach me things and all of that. Everybody in that group saying, oh, geez, I've heard all this before, but the other people haven't heard it, so you have to bear with it. From my perspective, it was accidental, right? You know, I'm just sitting in Jane Bell's class. He said, go ahead and do this. I just go ahead and do this. I'm at university, and I just go to the student newspaper, and I start doing it, and I just sort of start doing it. And literacy just happened. It happened while I was doing other things, doing things that I enjoyed doing, taking part in my own culture, if you will. And it's very clear to me how very different my own literacy could have been had my culture or my cultural surround been. I was in Toronto just a few days ago, and the speaker at the CAUCD conference from National Geographic, Amazon Explorer, and I thought that'd be a pretty cool person to have at the conference. Unfortunately, I forget his name, and my wireless access was a half hour short of what I needed, so we'll have to look it up later. But talk to the different cultural literacies. And in particular, he gave two examples. One example was the people who live in the Amazon forests and how the forest tells them what to do. One of the things he asked one of the elders was how they knew to put this berry and this leaf together to form a hallucinogenic. And the elder said, well, you just look at what the berry is telling you, and you look at what the leaf is telling you, and that's how you know that they go together and they react that way. Talking to the forest. Another example was the people in Polynesia who read the ocean, and the reflections of the waves off the islands tell them what their position is, and the size of the swells tells them where there's storms and things like that. And this reading, this kind of literacy, is embedded in the culture. It's part of culture. And I was wondering upstairs, is there indeed any difference between literacy and culture? And you know, I'm sitting here in this room today, and nothing against the organizer, but the acoustics are so. And that's okay. I mean, you know, for the most part, it worked all right and all of that. But I'm sitting here, and I'm with one group, and then another group, and another group, and I realize I'm not hearing. And I'm looking at everybody else, it's fine, I'm not hearing. And what's happening is this. I discovered this when I was trying to learn French. And I have the same problem with French. If I'm speaking with somebody in French, and it's a nice quiet room, it's no problem. But if it's a noisy room, there's more of a problem. Because what we do when we speak and we listen is we fill in the blanks. We hear part of a word, part of a sentence, a voice, a fragment, and we fill in the rest. And I realized as I was learning French that when I listen to somebody in English, mostly I'm not listening to them. Of course, I've had people tell me that anyway. mostly what's happening is I'm seeing part of it and filling in the rest. Inferring, if you will. But it's a completely automatic process. And literacy, it seems to me, is that enculturated process of filling in the blanks. It's the being so embedded in a community that you know what goes in the spaces. This is not my idea. I've gotten a note there, Thomas Kuhn. Thomas Kuhn talking about scientific knowledge and what it means to live inside the scientific paradigm defines it as being able to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. And any of you who have taken science or engineering courses know that the problems at the end of the chapter are not covered in the chapter. I've considered this to be like pure evil, personally. But the idea is that what they're trying to do is get you enculturated so that you just see what the answer should be. And that's how you become a scientist. But that's also how you become literate. So we heard from Barbara Gander this morning. And what we heard, at least what I heard, to a large degree, and I think we saw this echo, is that the culture of learning today is a culture of control. We can go through all the examples that have been happening in the blogosphere. I was talking to somebody about my own blog being banned by Education Queensland. It's also banned in Iran. So it's been freed up in Queensland now, so I'm very happy about that. It's still banned in Iran. I don't know what I've never offended the Iranians in my life. I actually like Iranians, but oh well. I had to type this all out because I wanted to make sure I got this exactly right. We have to wonder sometimes whether control is necessary to achieve the desired outcomes or whether control is the desired outcome. And I think those of you who know me know that my position on this is that control in the current system is the desired outcome. And so now the question becomes, how does blogging change that?
That might not.
I also listened to Scott Wilson, and restraint from throwing things at him. And he's happy about that. He'll have to live with him for a few more days over the next few weeks, so he may yet come to that. And Scott, maybe you can talk to him later, threw around papers and things. Here's some here. I hope that wasn't somebody's. Oh well. Papers about organizational cybernetics. And the thing I commented to him was, you've built in the hierarchy into the theory. Right? You got one person here who broadcasts, and another person here, or a bunch of people here, and they all get filtered.
Oh yeah, that's a massive theory, I know.
It was much more complicated than that.
Not much. That was pretty much it, right? You know, it's because, and it's the whole coordination thing. You got to have coordination. You could not possibly have coordinated action unless there was one person broadcasting to a mass. And I say, no. I mean, tell geese that. Tell ants that. Yeah, it's a simplification. But the point nonetheless remains valid that you have built the hierarchical principle, or not you, this is not your model necessarily, but the hierarchical principle has been built into the model. And what I want to assert is that there are other models of organization, and indeed, even in that last slide you showed, that hierarchical principle does not necessarily reflect itself in nature. And, you know, you look at social network dynamics again, and you get people like Clay Shirky and all of that talking about power laws. Power laws are inevitable. It's inevitable that we're going to have an inequality of resources, an inequality of links. It's just the way it is, but it isn't just the way it is. In power laws, in things like economics and blog links, you can have one person with a million times more than another person. But if you go look at a tree, the trunk of the tree isn't a million times larger than the branch. Because there are limitations built in nature. In the world of economics, we call those limitations taxation. People call them artificial, but not necessarily. And what I wanted to draw from what Scott said is that there is a tension, and this tension I felt in pretty much every group that I saw, between working within the system, the presumption that we already work and live in hierarchical societies, hierarchical structures, hierarchical organizations, and therefore must adapt to that and try to make those better, and working with what works, working with mechanisms for improving ourselves and our society that we know will carry us forward and won't destroy ourselves and our planet. And we come back to Barbara Gannon, who, think of her roundabout, asks the question, what if the system is broken? Put that question to Scott. Scott said, well, it's the system we've been using. Sorry, Scott, I'm just picking on you, but you're also like you're sitting in one of the high chairs, so you're really easy target. He said, it's the system we've been using for the last six centuries. I said, yeah, that's a great track record.
The switch between a good system and an ethical system,
It's not simply a question of whether it's a good system or an ethical system or a viable system. I would argue, and I think I can make the argument stand, that it's the system that is fundamentally broken. And the evidence that it's fundamentally broken is that if we keep up with this system, we will all die. Because we will have used up every bit of Earth's resources. We will possibly have silly nuclear war. So anyhow. But I'm getting a little off topic. Most of all, I think, and this question came up when I gave a talk called Community Blogging. And in Community Blogging, I made the point that people don't want to live in the long tail. They don't want to be the people who are never read. People want to be read. They want to be heard. They want to have a voice. They don't want to be filtered. They don't want to be broadcast to. They want to be involved in a conversation. And that is what the current system precludes. Remember back when you were taking English classes and they used a blackboard and chalk? Some of you, those of you who were my teacher. And if you wanted to be heard by people in China, you had to go and prostrate yourself in front of a publisher or something like that, because that was the only way you were ever going to be read anywhere beyond your immediate circle of friends. And if you wanted to broadcast your voice, you had to go to broadcasting school, and maybe if you were really lucky, get hired. Well, here I guess it would be by the BBC or something like that in Canada. This is CBC, of course. CBC only hired people that they knew. So. And it's that sort of thing. It's that imbalance that creates the unsustainability. And, I was in Alaska not too long ago, which I recommend, by the way, but that's an aside. And they'll probably do this, having conversation with the people there, and they think of, and they're not alone in this, and I'm not alone in this, think of what we're doing in blogging as being, in a certain sense, revolutionary, changing the world. But again, through the course of the day, as I thought about it more and more, and I actually made the comment, I think it was to Barbara, that we are not, in fact, the revolution. We are not, in fact, the agents of change in our own society. That is a task that is going to fall to the people who are today our students. We are, if you will, the Boethius of our current society. Boethius, that better be his name, or I'm going to sound really dumb on the podcast. Being a philosopher who wrote, capturing some of Aristotle's work in the last days of the Roman Empire, as the Goths came sweeping through Boethius's, in his, I don't know, I wanted to say cave, but I'm sure he lived in a house, but probably a stone one. Trying to write down the last little bits of knowledge before civilization as we knew it collapsed. And I wonder sometimes if that's not the case here, where, you know, Barbara said, we're the transition generation. We are the transition generation. We are not the people who are going to create the change, but we are the people who are going to write the last words of the old society. Another session asks, what are the digital skills that we're teaching us? So I'm wondering about that and some of the things that came up. What's a hyperlink? Spatial awareness, movement of files, how to use FTP, how to use a mobile phone, content awareness. Somebody raised the question, well, what if there are white supremacists out there on the website? And I'm sitting there thinking, well, these are the things we would have to teach ourselves, especially how to use a mobile phone, for me anyways. I'm not very good with mobile phones. I try, but I'm really not. But this sort of stuff, even the content awareness stuff, this is stuff that the children of today already know, isn't it? To some degree. And, you know, I hear a lot of people say, no, they don't know. They're like, again, in that discussion, somebody said, I told them, you know, you go on to this, you be careful, don't put out too much information, says the person. And then within half an hour, they'd all put their addresses up on the web. And, yeah, okay, there's a certain danger in that. But it doesn't follow from that they're not aware and not cognizant of the new technology, of the new culture. They follow from that they're young and learning, and some of them are going to learn the hard way, and others are going to learn by talking to each other, and some of them might even learn from us. But overall, these are people who have a much better grasp of what's real or what's not real in this new environment. I forget where I was reading it, but I was reading it just the other day. You know, kids grow up today using Photoshop. They know almost instinctively that anything that's a photo can be manipulated and probably is. As compared to us, we still get fooled by photographs that are printed in the newspaper. Oh yeah, there really were weapons of mass destruction there. Look! We do teach ourselves, and we teach ourselves the important things. And the kids today are teaching themselves the important things. What are the important things? How to walk across the road without getting killed. Trust me, when you go into another society, like me coming in here, it's an open issue all over again. You learn these things. What things you can eat that taste good, and what things you can eat that don't taste good. Again, one of these things that change through over cultures. How to communicate, how to get across, how to fill in the spaces. And the spaces, there are spaces in the cyber world as well as in the world of language, as well as in the world out there. And we, who are not necessarily inhabitants of the cyber world, we see these spaces and we see fear. We see these spaces and we say, you know, there's a gap here, there's a cognitive gap here, and we think, oh, predator. There's a gap here, and we think, oh, white supremacist. There's a gap here, we can't quite plug this up. Libel or bullying or whatever. Everywhere where we can't fill in the gap for ourselves, we see danger. And rightly so. You know, I come here to England, and if I don't know what's going on, my first reaction is, okay, be careful. Because I might get hit by a bus. You know, and the silliest things happen. I'm walking down Oxford Street yesterday, I'm trying to get to our dinner, and walking down Oxford Street, Oxford Circus, and there's a tunnel that goes under. I'm like, great, I'm going into the tunnel. I go into the tunnel, and okay, there's a subway station. Okay, that's no problem. I just need to cross the road and just go around. I'll go up the stairs again. I keep walking. I'm walking back the same direction I came from. That's the sort of thing that can happen. And, you know, if you don't know, if you don't see the gaps, you have to be cautious in that way. So we grant people their freedom with blogging, sort of. And what we find is people do the unexpected, or maybe they do the expected. Again, a comment that was made in one of the discussions. What happens when we let people just blog about whatever? Well, they blog about whatever. Just like me in my journal and my stories of Hemlock Holmes and Henry Higgins, I guess. And so, okay, we can't do that because it won't meet the educational objectives, which may be about control, but we won't go there. So we'll let them work within a framework where there's a structure, and we'll give them routes, like bus routes or a map, and we'll let them make choices within this framework, and that's like freedom. Well, it's kind of like choosing between Democrat or Republican kind of freedom. No, I'm just kidding. I know, I don't have a good analogy, but you know what I mean. That probably was a good analogy. And, you know, when blogging first came out, and it's still the case today, a lot of people said, great, got a blog, we'll make everybody in the class use the blogs, and we'll have them blog their assignments and all of that. And my reaction at the time, and my reaction still is, no, that'll break it. Somebody said, it was up there in that group, I can't remember what the group names were even. I'm scared of anything that's got to be assessed. And the reason for this, of course, is because as soon as something becomes assessed, you begin to think about the assessment rather than it is what you're doing. It's the argument, similar to the argument about standardized testing, right? You have standardized testing to evaluate your performance in class, then the work that you're doing in class becomes directed toward the test rather than the learning. And assessment in general is like that. If you realize you're going to be judged and evaluated, you conduct yourself differently. You conduct yourself in order to conform to the precepts of those who are evaluating. But a blog, said this same person, is more like a thing that you do where you think a lot. It's more like a place where you have your freedom. What does that mean? Well, Dana Boyd's written a couple of papers recently drawing this out, where blogging is an online activity that consists of a process of defining oneself and defining one's community. And this is something that not only do I agree with, but I can relate to on a personal level. I spent a lot of time in a thing called a MUD. A MUD, for those of you who don't know, is a multi-user dungeon. And when we tried to adapt it to the academic world, we had to change the name. You're not really welcome if you bring a dungeon into school. I always thought that was very ironic. And what a MUD is an online text-based environment where you appear as a character and are presented with different scenarios and move from room to room, and your objective is to find and kill monsters and collect treasure. And what's neat about a MUD is that you do this not by yourself, but in an environment with other people who have logged onto the same system from, well, anywhere in the world. And because this interaction takes place, and it takes place in this online environment, so much of it is abstracted, what happens is, in a MUD, you create your own identity. And in the MUD that I was in, it was called Mud Dog MUD. It was based at the University of Florida. I had the character. I was Labatt, the cat. I was a wizard. I was a senior wizard, and I was very proud to be a senior wizard because it meant I killed more monsters than And as Voight said, the same thing is happening today in places like MySpace. And you go to MySpace and you go from page to page. This is one of the things that I do in my own work. Kind of neat. I can call this working. I go from page to page to page in MySpace, looking at all these pages. And again, you can see people constructing and building their identity, testing different faces to the world. And it's not just the network of connections that they have with other people, although it is that. It's also the shared experiences, the commonalities, the conversations that they have. Again, in the group, somebody was saying, they're talking about somebody who was looking at my blog and seeing me with my picture by Niagara Falls, and who said, look, he's standing right where I stood. And this connection, this bond is formed by this shared experience, this common background, this common culture. And so, we hit a tension here, don't we? Because if blogging is defining ourselves, what is it that we're doing in the classroom? Well, I'm going to pick on Scott again. Because Scott talked about teaching as a type of work, and learning as a type of work, and work is, I know I'm mashing it again, but that's okay. And I'm sitting there and saying, oh no, it's all just a type of work, where work is this negotiated commitments between people. And I'm thinking, well, that doesn't sound like school to me. I didn't really remember a whole lot of negotiating happening there. And I'm thinking even that there's a distinction here between seeing ourselves as workers, seeing ourselves as people who go do our duty in some kind of structured society, and people as creative expressions of themselves. And I'm not explaining this nearly as well as I'd like to. That's what happens when you make this up quickly. But there's a tension here, isn't there? There's a tension between defining ourselves as we would like to be and defining ourselves as our schools would like us to be. That got him out of it. He's been sitting there in the back. You can't see him. He's sitting in the back. But finally, that got him out of it. So I'm happy now. I can move on to the next point. And I see the work that's being done in blogs as instances of self-expression. And when this is subjected to the constraints and strictures of school, it takes people's identities and substitutes that self-expression with some kind of identity, that person as worker, something like that. It replaces their identity with an identity that is being provided for them. I don't see it as something that's being negotiated. I see it as something that's being imposed. I see it as that hierarchy in action, the broadcaster not just transmitting a message to, but shaping the person. And so I work. But of course, that's what teachers do, isn't it? That was certainly Scott's point. And that's, you know, and again, I heard it over and over and over. I heard it in the discussion of accessibility about, you know, how we should be doing blogs, what we should be doing. I heard it people talking in literacy, how to get people to be literate, skills, all of that. The things that we want to teach or to show or to get students to do, we want to get them to write. We want to get them to be safe. We want to get them to have accessible websites. We want to get them to do this, to do that, to do the other thing. That's what teachers do, isn't it? But if we grant people the freedom to choose for themselves what they're going to do, to define their own identity, then what do teachers do? And in a paper I wrote recently, last fall, which nobody read, I shouldn't say that, as far as I can judge, it's true. I said that the role of a teacher, what constitutes teaching, is to model and demonstrate. Or in other words, in order to teach, you want to be the person you want your students to become. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means if you want them to be bloggers, you should be a blogger. If you want them to be a scientist, you should be a scientist. If you want them to be an activist, you should be an activist. Instead of trying to get the content from wherever and put it into their head, you leave them the freedom to make their own decision, because that is their natural state. And you instantiate the behavior you would like to see. As I was typing up there, I heard faint murmurings from down here about codes and bloggers' codes and things like that. I don't know what the discussion was, but there's always the acceptable use practices, bloggers' codes of ethics, whatever. That discussion comes up a lot. And I was thinking, there is no code, there is no ethic, there's no set of rules, there's no doctrine, there's nothing like that that can tell people how to be a good blogger. And if you don't believe me, think about how you conduct yourself in society. I presume none of you are murderers. Well, certainly hope not, anyways. If any of you are, don't tell me, I don't want to know. And those of you who are not murderers, I ask you, are you not murderers because the law says you shouldn't be? Well, no, that's not why we do not be murderers. Forget that grammar. That's probably grammatically correct, but it was awful. The reason why we are not murderers is not because there's some code that says don't be a murderer. The reason why we are murderers is because it is wrong to murder. And similarly, just the conduct of being a good citizen isn't something that will be captured in a code. It's just captured in our understanding of what it is to be a good citizen. As I say on the slide here, what matters is that we're honest with ourselves. That whatever we think is the thing that a person should be, that is what we do. And in the case of blogging, blogging. And each of us doing that ourselves creates a conversation, an interaction, a negotiation between equals without the hierarchy telling us what to do. And that's what produces literacy, and that's what in the end produces culture. It's not the slide, but there's places like Disney who think that they can tell us what culture will be, and culture will be whatever it's broadcast to be. But in the end, culture is the conversation that we have one-to-one, each of us. And hierarchy might be a way of organizing resources and organizing armies, but hierarchy isn't how we conduct ourselves in our world, and it isn't the way we move forward. That's my talk. I hope this is okay, and I thank you very much for your time and your attention.
She said, What if I keep taking the test over and over again, and then get up to a level, which is a really high spot, and I say, oh, I thought that's what it was. But there was this thing that somehow she was out of control, the government was out of control, if the kids actually took the test often enough to get really good at it. I'm not quite sure how that's relevant, but it seems sort of relevant.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure it's relevant either. Sorry, I had to say that. I don't know. I mean, we have this perception that it's a dog-eat-dog world out there and that we're all in competition with each other, which means there have to be winners and losers, successes and failures. And if you don't have failures, none of the successes mean anything. And, you know, and I hear that all the time, you know. People talking about, you know, the Chinese are coming, we have to compete against them. And every time people say that to me, I say to them, the Chinese are not our enemies. The other person in the class is not my enemy. I'm not competing against them. You know, each of us really is trying to make the best in life. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go out and get the other person. You know, people say competition is the root of everything. I tell them the story about when my friend and I decided to go from Edmonton to Calgary. We were asking ourselves, well, what's the best way to do this? Should we have a competition and race, or should we share a car? We decided to share a car. You know, it wasn't very competitive, and nobody won, but it was kind of like everybody passing, right? So, you know, when people say, you know, you can't just have people pass. There's a certain ethos, there's a certain worldview that's coming into play here, and it's the same sort of worldview, I think, that's skewing a lot of the things that we should be doing in school today. That's the best answer I can give to that.
I guess I'm thinking some of the similar things. One could argue that what we heard Darwin say this morning, let's slight to the experience of those that might already engage and do this way, makes them even better, putting that to the side. I'm sitting there thinking, all of those with conditions, those that don't engage at the moment, and I'm just writing on it, we can all say to people that this might be immediately relevant for the whole of this concept of blogging, that it's just not reaching the moment, you know, to make it relevant to the education, you know, to get them to re-engage or at least reflect on so they don't disengage in the whole learning process. And I feel in a way we're concentrating a bit today on looking at selecting the already successful ones. Can we tailor it to meet that other target that we can make this get through?
You know, I think, and it may be different here, I've heard a couple of remarks that suggest it is, but I think it's just a matter of time. I think that students are already engaged. Certainly in Canada they are. I did a talk in Edson, Alberta, and we looked at MySpace, and I got the people there. Edson, Alberta is a little town, about 5,000 people. It's in the middle of nowhere. Imagine a spruce forest the size of southern England. Edson's in the middle of it. Right. Had them open up MySpace, and on MySpace you can do a search for high schools. And so I had them search for their school, and discovered that pretty much everyone in the senior class is in MySpace. They're already engaged. They're already online. They have their own their pages, their presence, and it may be less so here, but again, it's only a matter of time. And it may be just because you don't know where they are, you don't know where to look yet. But they're there. And the people who are not engaged is us, the school system, because we are not taking education to the place where they already are. We're saying to them, you come to us. And what's going to change, what has to change, is that we will have to go to them. And the education will go into places like MySpace. But, you know, MySpace won't last that long. You know, and they'll move on to the next thing. But the education will go to them, to their world, where they live. Because when you think about it, how else would you do it? If you were building a system from scratch, would you make everybody come to a single place? I mean, that would be stupid. Right? You imagine, you know, like we've got instantaneous mass communications, person-to-person communications, almost limitless data storage capacity, online communications, video conferencing, all of that stuff. Given that environment, would we actually build buildings and have them physically transport themselves for months at a time? That would be stupid. In the electronic age, learning will go to where the learners are, which means we will have to adapt to that culture. And that culture is a culture of freedom. That's going to be very hard for us to do, and we, as I said, won't do it. We are speaking to the generation that will.
I think it was interesting, that was my question. I was asking about what is my role as a teacher. Asking about there. And it's funny, when I was doing blogging with 10-year-old kids, no one cared about blogging then. I had utter freedom. They had utter freedom. And I knew what my role was. I just got on with it, and we had brilliant experiences. And then what I found recently is that now that there's this element of control and management and people are interested in this stuff, I don't know what my role is anymore. But coming back to what you just said, I work 2 days, 1.5 to 2 days a week with kids who are failures by society standards. They've been through the pupil referral units, they've been excluded. Then they land on our doorstep here, and I have to engage them. And you know what? I've got freedom again, because no one cares about them, but I've got freedom again with these kids. And I know what my role is, and the technology flipping well works for you, and it happens. You know, and I find that so frustrating that I know what my role is when I'm given free rein to be expressive and creative. And so often we're not. But I guess the only answer is what both of you have been saying today is this kind of, well, actually, you've just got to go and do it yourself and make it happen yourself. I love what's come through both of you, really, that kind of model and demonstrate it. And I think this whole thing about this, what we're going to do with blog at .hc.uk, but whatever we do, we're going to blog and we're going to make sure we do it and not talk about it. And I find both of you really inspiring. Thank you. It's really got me buzzing again. Thank you.
This is just me, but I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that only teachers are passionate about making young people's lives better. But you said teachers have to be above all, and I asked why. You said because teachers are. It seems to me that parents might be passionate about making the lives of their children successful, and it seems to me that people who work and live in the community might have this passion, and it seems to me that a better place to give a kid a sense of the passions of a society is to have that kid in society itself rather than placed in some sort of abstract virtual world where nothing is real. That's my view.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. Again, there's a question of control. This perspective, I'm not a trained teacher or anything, my history of hazing. But I think it was the 1870 Education Act, is that right? That was put into place in the UK because people were starting to run through the streets of London, smashing windows, and everything was getting out of control. And so Victoria said, okay, everybody has to go to school from age 5 to 12 or whatever it was. That was less than 200 years ago. We've always taught like that. No, we haven't. We've always taught for thousands and thousands of years how to live in society. But the schools that we're kind of basing our assumptions on are less than 200 years old. Go back another 100 years with the Industrial Revolution, and suddenly all the workers have to get up at 5 a.m. They didn't have to do that before. Their lives were changed by the machines, by, you know, times, the time effects, and all these things that we talk about have always been like that. It's been that much time that things have been like that. And I think that the kind of learning that you're talking about, that's going back to real life. Because this is the Education Act stuff, and how it's been with the Industrial Revolution, the window knockers getting you up to go down to the mill. That's not real life, that's been a blip in human history. It's not just common time.
Yeah,
I think
something like that. The more modern the schools as they vary convinced that had two things in common, which was compulsory attendance and punctuality. So it's a spin off from the industrial revolution, which needed those qualities in the program.
There's an interesting little acronym word there, it's quite messy, that would be it. It kind of echoes up with my word, it's like made it down with polygons. The purpose of the system is what it does.
Yeah.
Rather than say, what does this do? This is their way of making the atmosphere, you know, actually, no, it doesn't. That's the issue with the paper. And therefore, the purpose of the system is we should piece of paper, and therefore, we should target your improvements, meaning, you know, maybe higher grade paper, better printing, bigger removal of faculty, bigger printing presses. So, you know, the political claim, the side effect is the main effect. So you can have an organization that's actually the main effect of all the system fails up.
So first year engineering class, the purpose of first year engineering class is to fail engineering students.
Very good. Do we have any more questions? Okay. I see a few sad faces. Right, so I'm going to wrap up. I'd like to say thank you again, Stephen, for that talk, and also to Barbara as well. And as well, thank